Killer. The fat woman laughed. I can't rightly say, my lord. I'm not one for telling them no. And all the local lads are grateful, I'm quite sure.
It's good to have you home, my lord, said one old man.
He looked to be at least 80, but he wore a studded brigantine and a long sword at his side.
How long will you be in residence?
As short a time as possible, Brian. Have no fear. Is the place habitable just now, would you say?
If we knew you was coming, we'd have laid down fresh rushes, my lord, said the crone. There's a dung fire burning.
Nothing says home like the smell of burning dung. Pataya turned to Sansa. Grisil was my wet nurse, but she keeps my castle now. Umfred's my steward, and Brian, didn't I name you Captain of the Guard last time I was here?
You did, my lord. You said you'd be getting some more men, too, but you never did. Me and the dog stand all the watches.
And very well, I'm sure. No one has made off with any of my rocks or sheep pellets. I see that plainly. Pataya gestured toward the fat woman. Keller minds my vast herds. How many sheep do I have at present, Keller? She had to think for a moment.
23, my lord. There was 29, but Brian's dogs killed one, and we butchered some others and salted down the meat.
Ah, coal, salt, mutton. I must be home. When I break my fast on gull's eggs and seaweed soup, I'll be certain of it.
If you like, my lord, said the old woman Grisel.
Lord Pataya made a face. Come, let's see if my hall is as dreary as I recall. He led them up the strand, over rocks slick with rotting seaweed. A handful of sheep were wandering about the base of the flint tower, grazing on the thin grass that grew between the sheepfold and thatched stable. Sansa had to step carefully. There were pellets everywhere. Within, the tower seemed even smaller. An open stone stair wound round the inside wall, from undercroft to roof. Each floor was but a single room. The servants lived and slept in the kitchen at ground level, sharing the space with a huge brindled mastiff and half a dozen sheepdogs. Above that was a modest hall, and higher still the bedchamber. There were no windows, but arrow slits were embedded in the outer wall at intervals along the curve of the stair. Above the hearth hung a broken longsword and a battered oaken shield, its paint cracked and flaking. The device painted on the shield was one Sansa did not know. A grey stone head with fiery eyes upon a light green field.
My grandfather's shield, Pataya explained when he saw her gazing at it. His own father was born in Braavos, and came to the Vale as a sellsword in the hire of Lord Corbury, so my grandfather took the head of the Titan as his sigil when he was knighted.
It's very fierce, said Sansa.
Rather too fierce for an amiable fellow like me, said Pataya. I much prefer my mockingbird.
Oswald made two more trips out to the Merlin King to offload provisions. Among the loads he brought ashore were several casks of wine. Pataya poured Sansa a cup, as promised.
Here, my lady, this should help your tummy, I would hope.
Having solid ground beneath her feet had helped already, but Sansa dutifully lifted the goblet with both hands and took a sip. The wine was very fine, an Arbor vintage, she thought. It tasted of oak and fruit and hot summer nights, the flavours blossoming in her mouth like flowers opening to the sun. She only prayed that she could keep it down. Lord Pataya was being so kind, she did not want to spoil it all by retching on him. He was studying her over his own goblet, his bright grey-green eyes full of, was it amusement? Or something else? Sansa was not certain.
Grisel, he called to the old woman, bring some food up, nothing too heavy. My lady has a tender tummy. Some fruit might serve, perhaps. Oswald's brought some oranges and pomegranates from the king.
Yes, my lord.
Might I have a hot bath as well? Asked Sansa.
I'll have Keller draw some water, milady.
Sansa took another sip of wine and tried to think of some polite conversation, but Lord Petar saved her the effort. When Grizel and the other servants had gone, he said, Lysa will not come alone. Before she arrives, we must be clear on who you are.
Who I don't understand.
Varys has informers everywhere. If Sansa Stark should be seen in the Vale, the eunuch will know within a moon's turn, and that would create unfortunate, complications. It's not safe to be a Stark just now. So we shall tell Lysa's people that you are my natural daughter.
Natural? Sansa was aghast. You mean a bastard?
Well, you can scarcely be my true-born daughter. I've never taken a wife. That's well known. And what shall you be called?
I could call myself after my mother.
Catelyn? A bit too obvious. But after my mother, that would serve. Elaine? Do you like it?
Elaine is pretty.
Sansa hoped she would remember.
But couldn't I be the true-born daughter of some knight in your service? Perhaps he died gallantly in the battle and—
I have no gallant knights in my service, Elaine. Such a tale would draw unwanted questions, as a corpse draws crows. It is rude to pry into the origins of a man's natural children, however. He cocked his head.
So, who are you? Elaine Stone, would it be? When he nodded, she said, But who is my mother? Keller? Please, no, she said, mortified.
I was teasing. Your mother was a gentlewoman of Braavos, daughter of a merchant prince. We met in Gulltown when I had charge of the port. She died giving you birth and entrusted you to the faith. I have some devotional books you can look over. Learn to quote from them. Nothing discourages unwanted questions as much as a flow of pious bleating. In any case, at your flowering, you decided you did not wish to be a scepter and wrote to me. That was the first I knew of your existence. He fingered his beard. Do you think you can remember all that?
I hope. It will be like playing a game, won't it?
Are you fond of games, Elaine?
The new name would take some getting used to.
Games, I suppose it would depend.
Grizel reappeared before he could say more, balancing a large platter. She set it down between them. There were apples and pears and pomegranates, some sad-looking grapes, a huge blood orange. The old woman had brought a round of bread as well, and a crock of butter. Petar cut a pomegranate in two with his dagger, offering half to Sansa. You should try and eat, my lady.
Thank you, my lord. Pomegranate seeds were so messy.
Sansa chose a pear instead and took a small, delicate bite. It was very ripe. The juice ran down her chin. Lord Petar loosened a seed with the point of his dagger. You must miss your father terribly, I know. Lord Eddard was a brave man, honest and loyal, but quite a hopeless player. He brought the seed to his mouth with a knife. In King's Landing, there are two sorts of people, the players and the pieces.
And I was a piece?
She dreaded the answer. Yes, but don't let that trouble you. You're still half a child. Every man's a piece to start with, and every maid as well. Even some who think they are players. He ate another seed. Cersei, for one. She thinks herself sly, but in truth she is utterly predictable. Her strength rests on her beauty, birth, and riches. Only the first of those is truly her own, and it will soon desert her. I pity her, then. She wants power, but she has no notion what to do with it when she gets it. Everyone wants something, Elaine, and when you know what a man wants, you know who he is and how to move him.
As you move Sir Dontus to poison Joffrey? It had to have been Dontus, she had concluded.
Littlefinger laughed. Sir Dontus the Red was a skin of wine with legs. He could never have been trusted with a task of such enormity. He would have bungled it or betrayed me. No, all Dantas had to do was lead you from the castle and make certain you wore your silver hairnet.
The Black Amethyst.
But if not Dantas, who? Do you have other pieces?
You could turn King's Landing upside down and not find a single man with a mockingbird sewn over his heart. But that does not mean I am friendless.
Pataya went to the steps.
Oswell, come up here and let the Lady Sansa have a look at you.
The old man appeared a few moments later, grinning and bowing. Sansa eyed him uncertainly.
What am I supposed to see?
Do you know him? Asked Pataya.
No.
Look closer.
She studied the old man's lined, windburnt face, hooked nose, white hair, and huge, knuckly hands. There was something familiar about him, yet Sansa had to shake her head.
I don't. I never saw Oswell before I got into his boat, I'm certain.
Oswell grinned, showing a mouth of crooked teeth.
No, but my lady might have met my three sons.
It was the three sons, and that smile, too.
Kettle Black.
Sansa's eyes went wide. You're a Kettle Black?
I'm a lady, as it please you.
She is beside herself with joy. Lord Pataya dismissed him with a wave, and returned to the pomegranate again as Oswell shuffled down the steps.
Tell me, Elaine, which is more dangerous, the dagger brandished by an enemy, or the hidden one pressed to your back by someone you never even see?
The hidden dagger?
There's a clever girl.
He smiled, his thin lips bright red from the pomegranate seeds.
When the imp sent off her guards, the queen had Sir Lancel hire sellswords for her. Lancel found her the Kettle Blacks, which delighted your little lord husband, since the lads were in his pay through his man Bronn. He chuckled. But it was me who told Oswell to get his sons to King's Landing, when I learned that Bronn was looking for swords. Three hidden daggers, Elaine, now perfectly placed.
So one of the Kettle Blacks put the poison in Joff's cup.
Sir Osmond had been near the king all night, she remembered.
Did I say that?
Lord Pataya cut the blood orange in two with his dagger and offered half to Sansa.
The lads are far too treacherous to be part of any such scheme, and Osmond has become especially unreliable since he joined the king's guard. That white cloak does things to a man, I find, even a man like him.
He tilted his chin back and squeezed the blood orange so the juice ran down into his mouth.
I love the juice, but I loathe the sticky fingers, he complained, wiping his hands.
Clean hands, Sansa. Whatever you do, make certain your hands are clean.
Sansa spooned up some juice from her own orange.
But if it wasn't the Kettle Blacks and it wasn't Sir Dantas, you weren't even in the city. And it couldn't have been Tyrion.
No more guesses, sweetling?
She shook her head.
I don't, Pataya smiled. I will wager you that at some point during the evening someone told you that your hairnet was crooked and straightened it for you.
Sansa raised a hand to her mouth.
You cannot mean... She wanted to take me to Highgarden, to marry me to her grandson.
Gentle, pious, good-hearted Willis Tyrell.
Regretful you were spared.
He would have bored you spitless.
The old woman is not boring, though. I'll grant her that. A fearsome old harridan, and not near as frail as she pretends. When I came to Highgarden to dicker for Margery's hand, she let her lord son bluster while she asked pointed questions about Joffrey's nature. I praised him to the skies, to be sure, whilst my men spread disturbing tales among Lord Tyrell's servants. And that is how the game is played. I also planted the notion of Sir Loras taking the white. Not that I suggested it. That would have been too crude. But men in my party supplied grisly tales about how the mob had killed Sir Preston Greenfield and raped the Lady Lawless, and slipped a few silvers to Lord Tyrell's army of singers to sing of Ryan Redwine, Serwyn of the Mirror Shield, and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight. A harp can be as dangerous as a sword in the right hands. Mace Tyrell actually thought it was his own idea to make Sir Loras's inclusion in the Kingsguard part of the marriage contract. Who better to protect his daughter than her splendid knightly brother? And it relieved him of the difficult task of trying to find lands and a bride for a third son. Never easy, and doubly difficult in Sir Loras's case. Be that as it may, Lady Olenna was not about to let Joffrey harm her precious, darling granddaughter. But unlike her son, she also realized that under all his flowers and finery, Sir Loras is as hot-tempered as Jaime Lannister. Toss Joffrey, Margaery, and Loras in a pot, and you've got the makings for Kingslayer stew. The old woman understood something else as well. Her son was determined to make Margaery a queen, and for that he needed a king. But he did not need Joffrey. We shall have another wedding soon, wait and see. Margaery will marry Tommen. She'll keep her queenly crown and her maidenhead, neither of which she especially wants. But what does that matter? The great Western alliance will be preserved, for a time at least.
Margaery and Tommen.
Sansa did not know what to say. She had liked Margaery Tyrell, and her small, sharp grandmother as well. She thought wistfully of Highgarden with its courtyards and musicians, and the pleasure barges on the Mander, a far cry from this bleak shore. At least I am safe here. Joffrey is dead, he cannot hurt me any more, and I am only a bastard girl now. Elaine Stone has no husband and no claim. And her aunt would soon be here as well. The long nightmare of King's Landing was behind her, and her mockery of a marriage as well. She could make herself a new home here, just as Pataya said. It was 8 long days until Lysa Aaron arrived. On 5 of them, it rained, while Sansa sat bored and restless by the fire beside the old blind dog. He was too sick and toothless to guard with Brian anymore. And mostly all he did was sleep. But when she patted him, he whined and licked her hand, and after that they were fast friends. When the rains let up, Pataya walked with her around his holdings, which took less than half a day. He owned a lot of rocks, just as he had said. There was one place where the tide came jetting up out of a blowhole to shoot 30 feet into the air, and another where someone had chiselled the 7-pointed star of the new gods upon a boulder. Pataya said that marked one of the places the Andals had landed, when they came across the sea to wrest the veil from the first men. Farther inland, a dozen families lived in huts of pile stone beside a peat bog. "Mine own small folk," Pataya said, though only the oldest seemed to know him. There was a hermit's cave on his land as well, but no hermit. He's dead now, but when I was a boy my father took me to see him. The man had not washed in 40 years, so you can imagine how he smelled, but supposedly he had the gift of prophecy. He groped me a bit and said I would be a great man, and for that my father gave him a skin of wine. Pataya snorted. I would have told him the same thing for half a cup. Finally, on a grey, windy afternoon, Brian came running back to the tower with his dogs barking at his heels to announce that riders were approaching from the southwest. "Lysa," Lord Pataya said, "come, Elaine, let us greet her." They put on their cloaks and waited outside. The riders numbered no more than a score, a very modest escort for the Lady of the Eyrie. 3 maids rode with her, and a dozen household knights in mail and plate. She brought a septon as well, and a handsome singer with a wisp of a moustache and long sandy curls.
Could that be my aunt?
Lady Lysa was 2 years younger than her mother, but this woman looked 10 years older. Thick auburn tresses fell down past her waist, but beneath the costly velvet gown and jewelled bodice her body sagged and bulged. Her face was pink and painted, her breasts heavy, her limbs thick. She was taller than Littlefinger and heavier, nor did she show any grace in the clumsy way she climbed down off her horse. Petar knelt to kiss her fingers. "The king's small council commanded me to woo and win you, my lady. Do you think you might have me for your lord and husband?" Lady Lysa pooched her lips and pulled him up to plant a kiss upon his cheek. "Oh, mayhaps I could be persuaded," she giggled. "Have you brought gifts to melt my heart?"
"The king's peace."
"Oh, pooh to the peace. What else have you brought me?"
"My daughter." Littlefinger beckoned Sansa forward with a hand. "My lady, allow me to present you Elaine Stone."
Lysa Arryn did not seem greatly pleased to see her. Sansa did a deep curtsy, her head bowed. "A bastard," she heard her aunt say. "Petar, have you been wicked? Who was her mother?"
"The wench is dead. I'd hope to take Elaine to the Eyrie."
"What am I to do with her there?"
"I have a few notions," said Lord Petar, "but just now I'm more interested in what I might do with you, my lady."
All the sternness melted off her aunt's round pink face, and for a moment Sansa thought Lysa Arryn was about to cry. "Oh, sweet Petar, I've missed you so. You don't know, you can't know. Young Royce has been stirring up all sorts of trouble, demanding that I call my banners and go to war. And the others all swarm around me, Hunter and Corbray and that dreadful Nesta Royce, all wanting to wed me and take my son to ward. But none of them truly love me, only you, Petar. I've dreamed of you so long."
"And I of you, my lady."
He slid an arm around behind her and kissed her on the neck.
"How soon can we be wed?"
"Now," said Lady Lysa, sighing. "I've brought my own septon, Anna Singer, and mead for the wedding feast."
"Here?"
That did not please him.
"I'd sooner wed you at the Eyrie, with your whole court in attendance."
"Pooh to my court! I've waited so long, I could not bear to wait another moment." She put her arms around him. "I want to share your bed tonight, my sweet. I want us to make another child, a brother for Robert, or a sweet little daughter."
"I dream of that as well, sweetling. Yet there is much to be gained from a great public wedding, with all the veil—"
"No," she stamped her foot. "I want you now, this very night, and I must warn you, after all these years of silence and whisperings, I mean to scream when you love me. I'm going to scream so loud they'll hear me in the Eyrie."
"Perhaps I could bed you now, and wed you later."
The Lady Lysa giggled like a girl. "Oh, Petar Baelish, you are so wicked. No, I say no. I'm the Lady of the Eyrie, and I command you to wed me this very moment."
Petar gave a shrug. "As my lady commands, then. I am helpless before you, as ever."
They said their vows within the hour, standing beneath a sky-blue canopy as the sun sank in the west. Afterward, trestle tables were set up beneath a small flint tower, and they feasted on quail, venison, and roast boar, washing it down with a fine light mead. Torches were lit as dusk crept in. Lysa Singer played "The Vow Unspoken" and "Seasons of My Love" and "Two Hearts That Beat as One." Several younger knights even asked Sansa to dance. Her aunt danced as well, her skirts whirling when Petar spun her in his arms. Mead and marriage had taken years off Lady Lysa. She laughed at everything so long as she held her husband's hand, and her eyes seemed to glow whenever she looked at him. When it was time for the bedding, her knights carried her up to the tower, stripping her as they went and shouting bawdy jests.
"Tyrion spared me that," Sansa remembered.
It would not have been so bad being undressed for a man she loved, by friends who loved them both. By Joffrey, though, she shuddered. Her aunt had brought only three ladies with her, so they pressed Sansa to help them undress Lord Petyr and march him up to his marriage bed. He submitted with good grace and a wicked tongue, giving as good as he got. By the time they had gotten him into the tower and out of his clothes, the other women were flushed, with laces unlaced, kirtles crooked, and skirts in disarray. But Littlefinger only smiled at Sansa as they marched him up to the bedchamber where his lady wife was waiting. Lady Lysa and Lord Petyr had the third-story bedchamber to themselves, but the tower was small, and true to her word, her aunt screamed. It had begun to rain outside, driving the feasters into the hall one floor below, so they heard most every word. "Petyr," her aunt moaned. "Oh, Petyr, Petyr, sweet Petyr, oh, 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 there, Petyr, there, that's where you belong." Lady Lysa's singer launched into a bawdy version of Milady's Supper, but even his singing and playing could not drown out Lysa's cries. "Make me a baby, Petyr," she screamed. "Make me another sweet little baby, oh, Petyr, my precious Petyr!" Her last shriek was so loud that it set the dogs to barking, and two of her aunt's ladies could scarce contain their mirth. Sansa went down the steps and out into the night. A light rain was falling on the remains of the feast, but the air smelled fresh and clean. The memory of her own wedding night with Tyrion was much with her. "In the dark, I am the Knight of Flowers," he had said. "I could be good to you." But that was only another Lannister lie. "A dog can smell a lie, you know," the Hound had told her once. She could almost hear the rough rasp of his voice. "Look around you and take a good whiff. They're all liars here, and everyone better than you." She wondered what had become of Sandor Clegane. Did he know that they'd killed Joffrey? Would he care? He had been the prince's sworn shield for years. She stayed outside for a long time. When at last she sought her own bed, wet and chilled, only the dim glow of a peat fire lit the darkened hall. There was no sound from above. The young singer sat in a corner playing a slow song to himself. One of her aunt's maids was kissing a knight in Lord Petyr's chair, their hands busy beneath each other's clothing. Several men had drunk themselves to sleep, and one was in the privy being noisily sick. Sansa found Brian's old blind dog in her little alcove beneath the steps and lay down next to him. He woke and licked her face. "You sad old hound," she said, ruffling his fur. "Elaine!" Her aunt singer stood over. "Sweet Elaine, I am Marillion. I saw you come in from the rain. The night is chill and wet. Let me warm you." The old dog raised his head and growled, but the singer gave him a cuff and sent him slinking off, whimpering. "Marillion," she said, uncertain, "you are kind to think of me, but pray forgive me, I'm very tired." "And very beautiful. All night I've been making songs for you in my head. A lay for your eyes, a ballad for your lips, a duet for your breasts. I will not sing them, though. They are poor things, unworthy of such beauty." He sat on her bed and put his hand on her leg. "Let me sing to you with my body instead." She caught a whiff of his breath. "You're drunk." "I never get drunk. Mead only makes me merry. I am on fire." His hand slipped up to her thigh. "And you as well. Unhand me. You forget yourself." "Mercy, I've been singing love songs for hours. My blood is stirred." "And yours, I know. There's no wench half so lusty as one bastard born. Are you wet for me?" "I'm a maiden," she protested. "Truly, oh, Elaine, Elaine, my fair maid, give me the gift of your innocence. You will thank the gods you did. I'll have you singing louder than the Lady Lysa." Sansa jerked away from him, frightened. "If you don't leave me, my father will hang you, Lord Petyr." "Littlefinger," he chuckled. "Lady Lysa loves me well, and I am Lord Robert's favourite. If your father offends me, I will destroy him
with a verse. He put a hand on her breast and squeezed. Let's get you out of these wet clothes. You wouldn't want them ripped, I know. Come, sweet lady, heed your heart. Sansa heard the soft sound of steel on leather.
Singer, a rough voice said. Best go, if you want to sing again.
The light was dim, but she saw a faint glimmer of a blade. The singer saw it too. Find your own wench. The knife flashed, and he cried out, You cut me.
I'll do worse, if you don't go.
And quick as that, Marillion was gone. The other remained, looming over Sansa in the darkness.
Lord Petyr said watch out for you.
It was Lothar Brune's voice, she realized. Not the hounds, no. How could it be? Of course, it had to be Lothar. That night, Sansa scarcely slept at all, but tossed and turned just as she had aboard the Merlin King. She dreamt of Joffrey dying, but as he clawed at his throat and the blood ran down across his fingers, she saw with horror that it was her brother, Rob. And she dreamed of her wedding night, too, of Tyrion's eyes devouring her as she undressed. Only then he was bigger than Tyrion had any right to be, and when he climbed into the bed, his face was scarred only on one side.
I'll have a song from you, he rasped,
and Sansa woke and found the old blind dog beside her once again. I wish that you were lady, she said. Come the morning, Grisel climbed up to the bedchamber to serve the lord and lady a tray of morning bread with butter, honey, fruit, and cream. She returned to say that Elaine was wanted. Sansa was still drowsy from sleep. It took her a moment to remember that she was Elaine. Lady Lysa was still abed, but Lord Petyr was up and dressed.
Your aunt wishes to speak with you, he told Sansa as he pulled on a boot. I've told her who you are.
Gods be good. I thank you, my lord. Petyr yanked on the other boot.
I've had about as much home as I can stomach. We'll leave for the Eyrie this afternoon.
He kissed his lady wife and licked a smear of honey off her lips, then headed down the steps. Sansa stood by the foot of the bed while her aunt ate a pear and studied her.
I see it now, the Lady Lysa said as she set the core aside. You look so much like Catelyn.
It's kind of you to say so.
It was not meant as flattery. If truth be told, you look too much like Catelyn. Something must be done. We shall darken your hair before we bring you back to the Eyrie, I think.
Darken my hair?
If it please you, Aunt Lysa, you must not call me that. No word of your presence here must be allowed to reach King's Landing. I do not mean to have my son endangered.
She nibbled the corner of a honeycomb.
I have kept the veil out of this war. Our harvest has been plentiful, the mountains protect us, and the area is impregnable. Even so, it would not do to draw Lord Tywin's wrath down upon us.
Lysa set the comb down and licked honey from her fingers.
You were wed to Tyrion Lannister, Petyr says, that vile dwarf.
They made me marry him. I never wanted it.
No more than I did, her aunt said. John Arryn was no dwarf, but he was old. You may not think so to see me now, but on the day we wed I was so lovely, I put your mother to shame. But all John desired was my father's swords to aid his darling boys. I should have refused him, but he was such an old man, how long could he live? Half his teeth were gone, and his breath smelled like bad cheese. I cannot abide a man with foul breath. Petyr's breath is always fresh. He was the first man I ever kissed, you know. My father said he was too low-born, but I knew how high he'd rise. John gave him the customs for Gulltown to please me. But when he increased the incomes tenfold, my lord husband saw how clever he was and gave him other appointments, even brought him to King's Landing to be master of coin. That was hard, to see him every day and still be wed to that old, cold man. John did his duty in the bedchamber, but he could no more give me pleasure than he could give me children. His seed was old and weak. All my babies died, but Robert, three girls and two boys. All my sweet little babies dead, and that old man just went on and on with his stinking breath. So you see, I have suffered too. Lady Lysa sniffed. You do know that your poor mother is dead.
Tyrion told me, said Sansa. He said the Freys murdered her at the Twins with Rob. Tears welled suddenly in Lady Lysa's eyes.
We are women, alone now, you and I. Are you afraid, child? Be brave. I would never turn away Cat's daughter. We are bound by blood.
She beckoned Sansa closer.
You may come kiss my cheek, Elaine.
Dutifully, she approached and knelt beside the bed. Her aunt was drenched in sweet scent, though under that was a sour, milky smell. Her cheek tasted of paint and powder. As Sansa stepped back, Lady Lysa caught her wrist.
Now tell me, she said sharply, are you with child? The truth now. I will know if you lie.
No, she said, startled by the question.
You are a woman, flowered, are you not?
Yes. Sansa knew the truth of her flowering could not be long hidden in the airy.
Tyrion didn't. He never.
She could feel the blush creeping up her cheeks.
I am still a maid. Was a dwarf incapable? No, he was only. He was.
Kind? She could not say that. Not here. Not to this aunt, who hated him so.
He had whores, my lady. He told me so. Whores?
Lysa released her wrist.
Of course he did. What woman would bed such a creature but for gold? I should have killed the imp when he was in my power, but he tricked me. Ooh, he's full of low cunning, that one. His sellsort slew my good Sir Vardis Egan. Catelyn should not have brought him here. I told her that. She made off with our uncle, too. That was wrong of her. The Blackfish was my knight of the gate, and since he left us, the mountain clans are growing very bold. But Tyre will soon set all that to rights, though. I shall make him Lord Protector of the Vale.
Her aunt smiled for the first time, almost warmly.
He may not look as tall or strong as some, but he is worth more than all of them. Trust in him, and do as he says.
I shall, aunt, my lady. Lady Lysa seemed pleased by that.
I knew that boy Joffrey. He used to call my Robert cruel names, and once he slapped him with a wooden sword. A man will tell you that poison is dishonourable, but a woman's honour is different. The mother shaped us to protect our children, and our only dishonour is in failure. You'll know that when you have a child.
A child? Said Sansa, uncertainly. Lysa waved a hand negligently.
Not for many years. You're too young to be a mother. One day you shall want children, though, just as you will want to marry.
I am married, my lady.
Yes, but soon a widow. Be glad the imp preferred his whores. It would not be fitting for my son to take that dwarf's leavings. But as he never touched you... How would you like to marry your cousin, the Lord Robert?
The thought made Sansa weary.
All she knew of Robert Aaron was that he was a little boy and sickly.
It's not me she wants her son to marry. It's my claim. No one will ever marry me for love.
But lying came easy to her now. I can scarcely wait to meet him, my lady. But he is still a child, is he not? He is 8. And not robust, but such a good boy, so bright and clever. He will be a great man, Elaine. The seed is strong, my lord husband said before he died, his last words. The gods sometimes let us glimpse the future as we lay dying. I see no reason why you should not be wed as soon as we know that your Lannister husband is dead. A secret wedding, to be sure. The lord of the Eyrie could scarcely be thought to have married a bastard. That would not be fitting. The raven should bring us the word from King's Landing once the imp's head rolls. You and Robert can be wed the next day. Won't that be joyous? It will be good for him to have a little companion. He played with Vardis Egan's boy when we first returned to the area, and my Stuart's sons as well, but they were much too rough, and I had no choice but to send them away. Do you read well, Elaine? Septa Mordain was good enough to say so. Robert has weak eyes, but he loves to be read too, Lady Lysa confided. He likes stories about animals the best. Do you know the little song about the chicken who dressed as a fox? I sing him that all the time. He never grows tired of it. And he likes to play hop frog and spin the sword and come into my castle. But you must always let him win. That's only proper, don't you think? He is the lord of the airy, after all. You must never forget that. You are well born, and the Starks of Winterfell were always proud. But Winterfell has fallen, and you are really just a beggar now. So put that pride aside. Gratitude will better become you in your present circumstances. Yes, and obedience. My son will have a grateful and obedient wife.
The Dragon Tamer. The night crept past on slow black feet. The R of the bat gave way to the R of the eel, the R of the eel to the R of ghosts. The prince lay abed, staring at his ceiling, dreaming without sleeping, remembering, imagining, twisting beneath his linen coverlet, his mind feverish with thoughts of fire and blood. Finally, despairing of rest, Quentin Martell made his way to his solar, where he poured himself a cup of wine and drank it in the dark. The taste was sweet solace on his tongue. So he lit a candle and poured himself another. "Wine will help me sleep," he told himself, but he knew that was a lie. He stared at the candle for a long time, then put down his cup and held his palm above the flame. It took every bit of will he had to lower it until the fire touched his flesh, and when it did, he snatched his hand back with a cry of pain. "Quentin, are you mad?" "No, just scared. I do not want to burn." "Geras, I heard you moving about. I could not sleep. A burn's a cure for that. Some warm milk and a lullaby might serve you well. Or better still, I could take you to the Temple of the Graces and find a girl for you." "A whore, you mean? They call them graces. They come in different colours. The red ones are the only ones who fuck." Geras seated himself across the table. "The scepters back home should take up the custom, if you ask me. Have you noticed that old scepters always look like prunes? That's what a life of chastity will do to you." Quentin glanced out of the terrace, where night shadows lay thick amongst the trees. He could hear the soft sound of falling water. "Is that rain? Your whores will be gone." "Not all of them. There are little snuggeries in the pleasure gardens, and they wait there every night until a man chooses them. Those who are not chosen must remain until the sun comes up, feeling lonely and neglected. We could console them." "They could console me, is what you mean." "That too. That is not the sort of consolation I'd acquire." "I disagree. Daenerys Targaryen is not the only woman in the world. Do you want to die a man-maid?" Quentin did not want to die at all. "I want to go back to Ironwood and kiss both of your sisters, marry Gwyneth Ironwood, watch her flower into beauty, have a child by her. I want to ride in tourneys, hawk and hunt, visit with my mother in Novus, read some of those books my father sends me. I want Cletus and Will and Maester Kedri to be alive again. Do you think Daenerys would be pleased to hear that I had bedded some whore?" "She might be. Men may be fond of maidens, but women like a man who knows what he's about in the bedchamber. It's another sort of sword play. Takes training to be good at it." The jibe stung. Quentin had never felt so much a boy as when he stood before Daenerys Targaryen, pleading for her hand. The thought of bedding her terrified him, almost as much as her dragon's head. What if he could not please her? "Daenerys has a paramour," he said defensively. "My father did not send me here to amuse the queen in the bedchamber. You know why we have come. He cannot marry her. She has a husband. She does not love Hisdar Zolorik. What has love to do with marriage? A prince should know better. Your father married for love, it said. How much joy has he had of that?" Little and less. Doran Martell and his Norvoshi wife had spent half their marriage apart and the other half arguing. It was the only rash thing his father had ever done, to hear some tell it. The only time he had followed his heart instead of his head, and he had lived to rue it. "Not all risks lead to ruin," he insisted. "This is my duty, my destiny. You are supposed to be my friend, Garrus. Why must you mock my hopes? I have doubts enough without your throwing oil on the fire of my fear. This will be my grand adventure. Men die on grand adventures." He was not wrong. That was in the stories, too. The hero sets out with his friends and companions, faces dangers, comes home triumphant. Only some of his companions don't return at all. "The hero never dies, though. I must be the hero. All I need is courage. Would you have Dorn remember me as a failure?" "Dorn is not like to remember any of us for long." Quentin sucked at the burn spot on his palm. "Dorn remembers Egan and his sisters. Dragons are not so easily forgotten. They will remember Daenerys as well. Not if she's died. She lives. She must. She has lost, but I can find her. And when I do, she will look at me the way she looks at her sellsword, once I have proven myself worthy of her. From Dragonback, I have been riding horses since I was 6 years old. And you've been thrown a time or three. That never stopped me from getting back into the saddle. You've never been thrown off 1,000 feet above the ground," Garrus pointed out, "and horses seldom turn their riders into charred bones and ashes. I knew the dangers. I'll hear no more of this. You have my leave to go. Find a ship and run home, Garrus." The prince rose, blew the candle out, and crept back to his bed and its sweat-soaked linen sheets. "I should have kissed one of the Drinkwater twins, or maybe both of them. I should have kissed them whilst they could. I should have gone to Norvus to see my mother and the place that gave her birth, so she would know that I had not forgotten her." He could hear the rain falling outside, drumming against the bricks. By the time the hour of the wolf crept upon them, the rain was falling steadily, slashing down in a hard, cold torrent that would soon turn the brick streets of Meereen into rivers. The three Dornishmen broke their fast in the pre-dawn chill. A simple meal of fruit and bread and cheese, washed down with goat milk. When Garrus made to pour himself a cup of wine, Quentin stopped him. "No wine. There will be time enough for drink afterward." "One hopes," said Garrus. The big man looked out toward the terrace. "I knew it would rain," he said in a gloomy tone. "My bones were aching last night. They always ache before it rains. The dragons won't like this. Fire and water don't mix, and that's a fact. You get a good cook fire lit, blazing away nice, then it starts to piss down rain, and next thing your wood is sodden and your flames are dead." Garrus chuckled. "Dragons are not made of wood, Arch." "Some are. That old King Aegon, the Randy one, he built wooden dragons to conquer us. That ended bad, though." "So may this," the prince thought. The follies and failures of Aegon the Unworthy did not concern him, but he was full of doubts and misgivings. The laboured banter of his friends was only making his head ache. "They do not understand. They may be Dornish, but I am Dorn. Years from now, when I am dead, this will be the song they sing of me." He rose abruptly. "It's time." His friends got to their feet. Sir Archibald drained the last of his goat's milk and wiped the milk moustache from his upper lip with the back of a big hand. "I'll get our mama's garb." He returned with a bundle they had collected from the tattered prince at their second meeting. Within were three long hooded cloaks, made from myriad small squares of cloth sewn together. Three cudgels, three short swords, three masks of polished brass, a bull, a lion, and an ape. Everything required to be a brazen beast. "They may ask for a word," the tattered prince had warned them when he handed over the bundle. "It's dog." "You are certain of that?" Garrus had asked him. "Certain enough to wager a life upon it." The prince did not mistake his meaning. "My life?" "That would be the one." "How did you learn their word?" "We chanced upon some brazen beasts, and Maris asked them prettily. But a prince should know better than to pose such questions, Dornish. In Pentos we have a saying, never ask the baker what went into the pie. Just eat." "Just eat?" There was wisdom in that, Quentin supposed. "I'll be the bull," Arch announced. Quentin handed him the bull mask. "The lion for me, which makes a monkey out of me." Garrus pressed the ape mask to his face. "How do they breathe in these things?" "Just put it on." The prince was in no mood for japes. The bundle contained a whip as well, a nasty piece of old leather with a handle of brass and bone, stout enough to peel the hide off an ox. "What's that for?" Arch asked. "Daenerys used a whip to cow the black beast." Quentin coiled the whip and hung it from his belt. "Arch, bring your hammer as well. We may have need of it." It was no easy thing to enter the great pyramid of Meereen by night. The doors were closed and barred each day at sunset, and remained closed until first light. Guards were posted at every entrance, and more guards patrolled the lowest terrace, where they could look down on the street. Formerly those guards had been unsullied. Now they were brazen beasts. And that would make all the difference, Quentin hoped. The watch changed when the sun came up, but dawn was still half an hour off as the three Dornishmen made their way down the servants' steps. The walls around them were made of bricks of half a hundred colours, but the shadows turned them all to grey until touched by the light of the torch that Garrus carried. They encountered no one on the long descent. The only sound was the scuff of their boots on the worn bricks beneath their feet. The pyramid's main gates fronted on Meereen's central plaza, but the Dornishmen made their way to a side entrance, opening on an alley. These were the gates that slaves had used in former days as they went about their master's business, where small folk and tradesmen came and went and made their deliveries. The doors were solid bronze, closed with a heavy iron bar. Before them stood two brazen beasts, armed with cudgels, spears, and short swords. Torchlight glimmered off the polished brass of their masks, a rat and a fox. Quentin gestured for the big man to stay back in the shadows. He and Garrus strode forward together.
"You come early," the fox said.
Quentin shrugged. "We can leave again if you like. You're welcome to stand our watch." He sounded not at all Gascari, he knew. But half the brazen beasts were freed slaves, with all manner of native tongues, so his accent went unremarked.
"Bugger that," the rat remarked. "Give us the day's word," said the fox.
"Dog," said the Dornishman. The two brazen beasts exchanged a look. For three long heartbeats, Quentin was afraid that something had gone amiss, that somehow Pretty Maris and the tattered prince had gotten the word wrong. Then the fox grunted.
"Dog, then," he said. "The door is yours."
As they moved off, the prince began to breathe again. They did not have long. The real relief would doubtless turn up shortly. "Arch," he called, and the big man appeared, the torchlight shining off his bull's mask.
"The bar, hurry."
The iron bar was thick and heavy, but well oiled. So Archibald had no trouble lifting it. As he was standing at on end, Quentin pulled the doors open, and Garrus stepped through, waving the torch.
"Bring it in now. Be quick about it."
The butcher's wagon was outside, waiting in the alley. The driver gave the mule a lick and rumbled through, iron-rimmed wheels clacking loudly over bricks. The quartered carcass of an ox filled the wagon bed.
along with two dead sheep. Half a dozen men entered afoot. Five wore the cloaks and masks of brazen beasts, but pretty Meris had not troubled to disguise herself. "Where is your lord?" he asked Meris.
"I have no lord," she answered. "If you mean your fellow prince, he is near with 50 men. Bring your dragon out, and he will see you safe away, as promised. Kago commands here."
Sir Archibald was giving the butcher's wagon the sour eye.
"Will that cart be big enough to hold a dragon?" he asked.
"Should. It's held 2 oxen."
The corpse killer was garbed as a brazen beast, his seamed, scarred face hidden behind a cobra mask, but the familiar black arrack slung at his hip gave him away.
"We were told these beasts are smaller than the Queen's monster."
"The pit has slowed their growth." Quentin's readings had suggested that the same thing had occurred in the Seven Kingdoms. None of the dragons bred and raised in the dragon pit of King's Landing had ever approached the size of Vhagar or Meraxes, much less that of the Black Dread, King Aegon's monster.
"Have you brought sufficient chains?"
"How many dragons do you have?" said Pretty Meris. "We have chains enough for 10, concealed beneath the meat."
"Very good." Quentin felt light-headed. None of this seemed quite real. One moment it felt like a game, and the next like some nightmare, like a bad dream where he found himself opening a dark door, knowing that horror and death waited on the other side, yet somehow powerless to stop himself. His palms were slick with sweat. He wiped them on his legs and said, "There will be more guards outside the pit."
"We know," said Gerris. "We need to be ready for them."
"We are," said Arch.
There was a cramp in Quentin's belly. He felt a sudden need to move his bowels, but knew he dare not beg off now.
"This way, then."
He had seldom felt more like a boy. Yet they followed, Gerris and the big man, Meris and Kago, and the other windblown. Two of the sellswords had produced crossbows from some hiding place within the wagon. Beyond the stables, the ground level of the Great Pyramid became a labyrinth, but Quentin Martell had been through here with the Queen, and he remembered the way. Under 3 huge brick arches they went, then down a steep stone ramp into the depths, through the dungeons and torture chambers, and past a pair of deep stone cisterns. Their footsteps echoed hollowly off the walls, the butcher's cart rumbling behind them. The big man snatched a torch down from a wall sconce to lead the way. At last a pair of heavy iron doors rose before them, rust-eaten and forbidding, closed with a length of chain whose every link was as thick around as a man's arm. The size and thickness of those doors was enough to make Quentin Martell question the wisdom of this course. Even worse, both doors were plainly dinted by something inside trying to get out. The thick iron was cracked and splitting in 3 places, and the upper corner of the left-hand door looked partly melted. 4 brazen beasts stood guarding the door. 3 held long spears. The 4th, the sergeant, was armed with short sword and dagger. His mask was wrought in the shape of a basilisk's head. The other 3 were masked as insects.
"Lucas," Quentin realized.
"Doug," he said. The sergeant stiffened. That was all it took for Quentin Martell to realize that something had gone awry.
"Take them,"
he croaked, even as the basilisk's hand darted for his short sword. He was quick, that sergeant. The big man was quicker. He flung the torch at the nearest locust, reached back, and unslung his warhammer. The basilisk blade had scarce slipped from its leather sheath when the hammer spike slammed into his temple, crunching through the thin brass of his mask and the flesh and bone beneath. The sergeant staggered sideways half a step before his knees folded onto him and he sank down to the floor, his whole body shaking grotesquely. Quentin stared, transfixed, his belly roiling. His own blade was still in its sheath. He had not so much as reached for it. His eyes were locked on the sergeant, dying before him, jerking. The fallen torch was on the floor, guttering, making every shadow leap and twist in a monstrous mockery of the dead man shaking. The prince never saw the locust spear coming toward him until Geras slammed into him, knocking him aside.